May it please the Court. It's undisputed that Mrs. Malave is entitled to stay in the United States if she did not commit marriage fraud. Marriage fraud is committed when an alien's intent was to marry solely for the purpose of evading immigration laws. Mrs. Malave testified under oath, subject to cross, that she intended the marriage to be real, that she married for love and to create a family and for her and her one-year-old son. She testified that her marriage was consummated, that she lived with Mr. Malave, and that she chose to separate from him when she discovered that he was in bed with another man. The government's sole evidence of marriage fraud here is her estranged husband's hearsay statements that the marriage was a sham, and the IJ and the BIA relied exclusively on those statements to find the marriage was a sham. Mrs. Malave testified that Mr. Malave's accusations...
For this in detail, jurisdiction is always the first question in a case, and the Attorney General argues that we have none, so perhaps you would address that first.
Yes, Your Honor. This Court has jurisdiction to review this case. NACARO 202F does not apply because Ms. Malave is challenging the procedures leading to the final order of removal, procedures which are rooted in and arise from...
I don't understand that. That's the same argument that this Court rejected in Ali in saying that even though the final decision is unreviewable, the alien said yes, but you can review the procedures leading to it, like the denial of a continuance. And we said in Ali that that was just a request for an advisory opinion. So that theme isn't going anywhere unless we overrule Ali, which I think is unlikely.
This case is quite distinguishable from Ali, and in Ali, the procedure at the right at issue was discretionary. Here, Ms. Malave has a non-discretionary right to status adjustment under NACARA.
But the statute says we can't review the Attorney General's decision under the Nicaraguan, etc. Getting rid of acronyms always helps us amateurs.
Yeah. Well, what NACARA says is that the court is...
Getting rid of acronyms always helps us amateurs.
Well, NACARA strips the court
of jurisdiction. Getting rid of the Nicaraguan.
Oh, so...
I'm suggesting that you argue the case without the use of acronyms that do not come trippingly off the tongue.
You
refer to it as the act. For example.
The Act. Okay. Well, we can refer to NACARA as the Act. So 202F of the Act strips a court of jurisdiction only to review determinations on the merits. Ms. Malave is not asking for a determination on the merits. She's simply asking...
That's the very theme that we said in Ali was just a request for an advisory opinion. It's like saying that if you have 30 days to file a notice of appeal and file the notice of appeal on the 40th day, nonetheless, you can ask the Court of Appeals to review the procedures leading to the district court's judgment, even though the Court of Appeals can't review the district court's judgment. And it doesn't work. Why don't you follow, your real argument is the one that was adopted by, I believe, the 11th Circuit, which says, look, the final order here is not one under the Act, under the Nicaraguan Act. It's one under the Immigration Act. It's a final order of removal. And we can review that, even though we can't say boo about the Nicaraguan Act.
And that is our argument, Your Honor. So,
good.
Unless there are any other questions about jurisdiction, may I move on to the merits? Mrs. Malave testified that Mr. Malave's accusations were lies, and she would have exposed the lies if she had the opportunity to cross-examine him. However, Mr. Malave never appeared for cross-examination, and the hearsay was admitted even though they were impeached by Mrs. Malave's testimony, contained inaccuracies even independent of her testimony. No one testified to corroborate or authenticate the statements. He was an interested witness, and the statements were written in a language that Mr. Malave does not speak or write. So in the final analysis, these statements are unreliable.
I guess the very first question is, who bears the burden of showing that our marriage is a sham? Does she bear the burden of showing that it was not a sham, or does the government bear the burden?
This is an interesting issue. Mrs. Malave has the burden basically to prove a negative that the marriage is not a sham. So she here first has the burden to prove eligibility under the Act, which she did, and then the government has to bring up some scintilla of evidence in order to bring the marriage fraud issue in. And so they look to the hearsay statements as evidence and the sole evidence of the fraud here.
Counsel, there are two things that you might be arguing, and I'm not sure which you are arguing, but they seem to me materially different. One, you might be saying that suppose the immigration people search for the husband and discover that he is dead, so there's no possibility of supplementing his statement. One way to understand your argument is you're saying that would not be substantial evidence because there's still too many problems with that statement. The second thing you might be arguing is that the Immigration Service has a duty to provide a subsidy in kind to the alien by going out and sending a team of investigators rather than leaving it to the alien to issue a subpoena. Are you making the first argument or only the second?
We're making both, Your Honor. In Your Honor's particular hypothetical, Mr. Malave is dead. We don't know that. So in terms of...
Let me tell you why I think it matters. The Supreme Court decided in Richardson against Perales, a case that neither side mentions, that it's perfectly fine to use hearsay in administrative proceedings and leave to the private citizen, the claimant, your client, the duty of issuing a subpoena and bringing the witness in for cross-examination. The court did not require, court held that the agency was not required to produce the witness. The need is to issue a subpoena. And one would think that would pretty much take care of the second branch of your argument, but it doesn't take care of the first branch. That's why I think it potentially matters a lot whether you're making one argument or both.
While I cannot speak to the facts of Richardson because those were not cited in the brief.
Indeed, that's a big problem. We have that is the most recent decision of the Supreme Court on the use of hearsay in agency proceedings. One would hope that it's a subject that would be addressed by the parties.
I'm not sure, however, if in that court the Supreme Court discussed accommodation of the statutory right to cross-examination.
There's a statutory right to cross-examination in Richardson. There's no doubt the Supreme Court said the Constitution entitles the claimant, this is for disability benefits, to due process. There was a statutory right to cross-examine. There was a regulatory entitlement to cross-examine. But the Supreme Court said that the agency fulfills its duty by producing the written statement, and the private party can then issue a subpoena to bring the declarant in for cross-examination. That's adequate, the court said.
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, at first we should note that the government concedes that it made no effort to find Mr. Malave.
Of course not. It never makes that effort anymore in Social Security cases as a result of...
Well, there are other cases such as in the BIA, whose interpretations of the right to statutory right to cross-examination, and other circuits that...
Maybe I'm not being clear. There are an awful lot of things that private parties in the immigration and other agency proceedings have a statutory or regulatory right to. The alien has a statutory right to counsel. That doesn't mean the Immigration Service pays for the counsel. Right? There's a big difference, as the Supreme Court keeps saying, between a right to do X and a right to be subsidized in doing X by the government. The second branch of your argument, that is that the ICE needs to send people out to find Mr. Malave, is an argument for a subsidy by the government. The normal rule in civil litigation is that if you don't like the other side's testimony, you issue a subpoena and bring the witness in. You just think about how it works where the discovery occurs outside the 100-mile radius from the district court.
Well, Mrs. Malave here did request a subpoena, and she was denied a subpoena. So not only did...
Oh, well, now you're getting into a real statutory right.
Well, so here, in this case where the IJ didn't push the government to vindicate her rights or to accommodate her rights where the government didn't accommodate her rights, and the IJ didn't and the IJ denied a subpoena here. She was totally, her right to cross-examination was eviscerated. It might as well have not existed because she was never provided the opportunity for cross. I see my time is up. If there are any other questions before I sit down?
Rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. Ms. Hoffberg. Well, Ms. Hoffberg, let's start where Ms. Kim just ended. She says that the alien asked for a subpoena to go and serve on Malave, and the immigration judge refused to issue it. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because of the...
This is a slam dunk for refusing to enforce the order. Everybody has a statutory and constitutional right to a subpoena to go find the declarant.
Your Honor, a couple things on that matter. First of all, you mentioned the case of Richardson and the private citizen's ability to issue to get a subpoena, and that's correct. And the government did cite...
The Supreme Court was crystal clear in Richardson that the private citizen had a right to a subpoena to go, had a right to compulsory process to bring in the declarant.
Your Honor, this court did recognize essentially the Richardson decision without citing it in Alimi, which is cited by the government in its brief, where Alimi says that there is no affirmative duty on the part of DHS to present a witness, and that is citing...
Look. There are different questions here. If what the alien asked for is a subpoena, then the alien's going to go out, hire a process server, try to track down her husband. And if that's what she asked for and what the immigration judge said you can't have, we've got a violation of the Constitution, a statute, and a regulation all at once.
The government respectfully disagrees that a subpoena would have made a difference. And the issue
make
is
any
prejudice.
She's entitled to it, whether you think it would make any difference or not.
If she was entitled to it, which the government argues that the immigration judge had good reasons for refusing to grant her one, but the end question then is the prejudice. If there was a violation, if this court is going to find that there was somehow a violation.
The prejudice is that the woman is going to be sent back to, the prejudice couldn't be greater. Look, if the government is producing the affidavits and indeed resting its entire case on them, then why would it be her burden to find the person who signed the affidavits without having the right of a subpoena? I mean, that is extremely backwards. You know, we've got these affidavits that on their face are not consistent with each other, and you weren't required to authenticate them or produce the declarant. These are your only proof, and you've got, an IJ saying, nope, you can't have your subpoena. This is Alice in Wonderland. This is the kind of stuff that drives federal judges to the brink of insanity.
We deny that any of the three of us has arrived there yet.
Wait a minute.
Okay, one of us has arrived there, but the other two are still well back from the brink.
Your question goes to the heart of the question that you asked Petitioner's Counsel, which is who has the burden in this case? And the government did not have the burden, and that is the critical key factor distinguishing this case.
No, the critical key factor is what did you do to allow her, if indeed she is the one with the burden, what did you do to allow her to take on and carry out that responsibility? And what you did was you estopped her.
The government offered to have the officers who took the statements from Mr. Malav come in, and that was the government's attempt in this case to enable the petitioner to have an opportunity to confront the evidence, because Mr. Malav his whereabouts had been unknown for 10 years, and so that was part of the reason why the IJ asked her specifically, have you tried to find him? What efforts have you made? And it appeared to be fruitless at this point to issue a subpoena. The government offered to have the officers come in and testify regarding the statement.
She didn't want the officers. She wanted him.
Yeah.
Well, but the government made an attempt in that regard. The government offered to have them come in.
See the point. The normal way you figure out whether a subpoena is fruitless is to issue it and see whether it can be served. If you issue it and the process server says, I've tried, but I can't find him, then we know it's fruitless. But trying to predict whether a subpoena will be fruitless sounds like a snipe hunt.
Well, Your Honor, the IJs, that's part of the reason why they deny continuances in other cases. They're trying to predict when a visa petition might become available, and they're trying to predict all kinds of things in the future when people ask, you know, can I have my proceedings held because potential things might happen. And when it's uncertain, and this happens in the course of adjudicating continuance denials for visas, I understand that this court lacks jurisdiction entirely over continuances under its case law, but in other circuits, when the immigration judge decides that it's an uncertain event in the future at some unknown time and place and whatever, they decide that they don't have to grant that continuance. They don't have to continue the proceedings to allow an unknown event to occur. And in this case, they decided that his absence for 10 years, and in light of the petitioner saying, I did try to find him at a certain point in time and I was unable to, she's that much less likely to be able to find him at this point in time because it's been 10 years later.
You never know. He might be living down the street for her. But she didn't see him.
One of the great things about America is everybody's entitled to rise to the height of becoming a failure. But so she misses, but she has to be accommodated when she asks for a subpoena.
And, of course, we have the division of labor. Process servers are often rather better at finding skips than you or I.
Well, Your Honor, it was her burden to try to find him and to make her case regardless of the subpoena.
That's what she was trying to do when she asked for the subpoena.
Well, but she had plenty of time prior to asking for the subpoena to find him. This case was going on since September 1997. Remember, she found out the day of her interview that her visa was being withdrawn because allegedly she paid Mr. Malab $1,000 to marry him. And that was told to her the day that her visa petition was withdrawn. So for 10 years, she had the opportunity to find him. And then she asked for a subpoena to
bring him in to testify before the immigration judge, not to talk to him at some other time. Now, your best argument would be, if it's accurate, that she had been told by the immigration services lawyers that they were going to introduce this affidavit, and so she should have asked the immigration judge to issue a subpoena before the day of the hearing.
And, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct, because that was part of the government's argument, is that she was given proper notice of the statements. And she had notice of the statements as early, definitely, by April 7, 2005, when the service denied her application for NACARA adjustment and specifically stated within its denial, there were these statements that exist by Mr. Malav, and he said that you paid him $1,000 to marry him. And she never asked once at any of the master calendar hearings, and there were five master calendar hearings leading up to the introduction of the evidence, and she never once asked about them. Oh, I see that there are these statements. Where are they? I need to find him now. She never said that. So then she tries to find him then 10 years later, after she had the opportunity to gather all evidence in her favor to meet her burden of admissibility. And again, I want to clarify that the government did not have the burden. The government did not charge her with visa fraud, and that was made very clear on the record that the DHS attorney said, we're just charging her as entered without inspection, which she conceded the removability on that ground. There was no burden for the government by clear and convincing evidence to show the visa fraud. On the other hand, it was her burden to show clearly and beyond a doubt that she was admissible so that she could get the NACARA adjustment relief that she sought.
A little bit earlier, if I might break in, You said that she had waived authentication of the affidavits. On page 18 of the gray brief, we are told that nothing in the record supports your assertion that she waived the opportunity to cross-examine the INS agents.
Yes, and that's because...
On the authenticity... May I finish, please?
Oh, yes.
I know it's hard for you, but it's hard for me too. On the authenticity of the affidavits, where in the record will we find her attorney making that waiver?
Your Honor, I agree that that conversation of the waiver is not on the record. What is on the record is the conversation at the next calendar hearing where the DHS attorney specifically states, I previously offered counsel the opportunity that I would bring in the officers, but he never says,
incorrect. That doesn't cut it in America.
Hearsay about the record.
We can't come in later and say, you know, I actually said that. It may not be in the record.
Well, why didn't he object then? I mean, the issue is if it weren't true or if he had changed his mind at that point, he could have intervened and said, oh, no, actually, we do want the officers to come in. Oh, I don't recall that conversation. The fact is he never objected to the truth of the DHS attorney stating on the record, I offered to bring in the officers.
Look, she didn't waive, but why in the world they would want those officers is absolutely beyond me.
Well, she was arguing in part that he may have been coerced or that he had trouble understanding
what they were telling him. Right, and the agents are going to come in and say, we coerced her?
That there was an interpreter and that there were two of us there who both witnessed him voluntarily giving the statements and that he understood what he was saying and the nature of the discussion to show, you know, what their perspective was of his demeanor, of his ability to, convey his thoughts voluntarily. And that is something very critical in this case because in other cases you can see that, you know, the government is, if it's required to make any effort at all, this was the government making effort. And arguably in this case, the government did not have that burden because that right to cross-examination, I submitted a 28J letter for the case of Dumbia, where it says that the promise of an opportunity offered by 1229 AB4 should not be confused to mean that the federal rules of evidence apply in immigration proceedings. They do not. And this court made very clear that the only test is whether evidence is probative and its admission fundamentally fair. And so under that rubric, this court should review that the fact that there were two INS officers who witnessed it, that the statement was translated, and that the statement was produced on an official government form, an affidavit form that's used in the course of business.
Now, are you seriously contending that when an government official writes down a person's statement, the truth of the statement is somehow more likely because it's been recorded by a government official? Well, I mean, it might be reasonable to say that the I-25 form is evidence that this is the story that Mr. Maldave told the agents, but how is the truth of the story enhanced just by being recorded by some government agent? The agent isn't vouching for the truth. The agent is just saying, look, this is what I was told by the witness.
Well, Your Honor, in many cases...
What is this official government document?
Well,
argument.
That argument sort of stemmed from the fact that the I-213, which is also completed by a government official, and yes, the government acknowledges that that is when the alien is making statements himself, but then the alien's later contradicting those statements, and yet the court pulls out that I-213 and says, oh, but the officer recorded that you said these statements.
Look, an I-213 statement comes from the alien herself.
Yes.
And she can testify about the contents. But an I-215 contains a statement of a third party. There's, no one here who can answer some very good questions about the inconsistencies in the two statements that were taken that day, or who can tell us about the circumstances under which those statements were taken.
Your Honor definitely has a point in that, but the problem is that it's her burden then to show other evidence. You know, the fact that the government, these statements were somehow going to be
by asking for, forgive me, but by asking for a subpoena, that's what she was hoping to do. Look, she's a poverty-stricken woman.
Not if she has $1,000 to pay someone to marry her.
That's unfair.
Well, Your Honor, the government sees that point in this, but it was her burden. And if you look at the other evidence that she produced to try to show the validity of her marriage, this is very important because she also could have produced evidence to meet her burden to show that it was a bona fide marriage. And all of the evidence had problems with it.
This poor woman, you've got her proving so many negatives, you know, that she doesn't have a sham marriage, that she is not a felon, that she does not have some other disqualifying condition, that she has money.
And there is a high burden to show admissibility, and she did have that burden to show her eligibility for the relief that she sought, and the burden was always on her. And the fact is she knew that from the beginning when she first applied for the NACARA adjustment, that the burden was on her. Now, if I see that my time is running out, and I did want to address the jurisdictional part of this case. I know that we usually address jurisdiction first, but in this case we went right to this merits aspect. And as far as the jurisdiction goes, it's our contention that 202F certainly bars jurisdiction. This court pointed out that when the end result is unreviewable, as in this case, other routes along the way, such as continuances, are also unreviewable, and continuances are also unreviewable in and of themselves. What the government is...
The end result here is an order of removal under the Immigration and Nationality Act, and not the final judgment is not an order under the Nicaraguan Act.
But if you look at the way that the statute is actually worded, and you look at the exact language of 202F, it's stating that the status of any alien should be adjusted under whether the status should be adjusted is final and shall not be subject to review by any court. So it's very, very explicit, and it's the government's position that only substantial constitutional claims, as this court decided in Dave, which was decided after St. Cyr but before the enactment of 242A2D, and you brought up that the 11th Circuit has found...
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything further, Ms. Kim?
I'll be brief, Your Honors. I believe the court has covered everything that I would have covered. The one item...
There you go.
The only one item that I did want to address was this 10-year notice issue, because that's just a mischaracterization of the facts. What the facts show here is Mrs. Malave had a good reason to believe that the government didn't credit Mr. Malave's statements until 2005. And then in 2005, when her application was rejected, she renewed her application in front of the immigration court. And after he rejected that renewed application, at the very first hearing after that, the government produced the hearsay statements. And as soon as the government produced the hearsay statements, she requested for a subpoena. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kim. The case is taken under advisement.